This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's son. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
The title of this installment is The Murder of Mary Fagan, Part 2. Mary Fagan was born in Florence, Alabama in 1899. She was born 4 months after her father had died into a family that had farmed in Georgia for generations. Frances Fagan, her mother, eventually remarried, and they lived briefly in Alabama before moving back to Marietta, Georgia. Fagan's mother opened a boarding house there, and her children took jobs in the local mills. Mary Fagan left school at 10 to work part-time in a textile mill. She was hired in 1911 by a paper manufacturer. In 1912, her mother remarried, and she and the children moved to a poor neighborhood in the city of Atlanta. Fagan took a job with the National Pencil Company in the spring of 1912, where she ran a knurling machine that inserted rubber erasers into the brass bands at the end tip of pencils. Knurling is a manufacturing process. I didn't know this. I'd look it up myself. It's spelled with a K-N. It's a manufacturing process whereby this diamond-shaped pattern is cut or rolled into metal, like you'd see in the metal at the end of a pencil. Mary had been laid off the previous Monday, April 21st, 1913, as a result of a shortage of brass sheet metal supplies. She worked on the same floor as Leo Frank, which was the second floor of the National Pencil Company, though Fagan worked in a different area. Fagan labored in a section of the metal room known as the tipping department. Most of the child laborers, like Fagan, worked 11-hour shifts, 5 to 6 days a week, in horrendous conditions and for just pennies an hour. Leo Frank was born in Texas. The town is spelled C-U-E-R-O, Cuero or Suero. Don't know how that's pronounced exactly. His family moved to Brooklyn, New York in 1884 when Frank was just 3 months old. He attended New York City public schools and graduated from Pratt Institute in 1902. He then attended Cornell University, where he studied mechanical engineering. After graduation in 1906, Frank worked briefly as a draftsman and then as a testing engineer before accepting a position with a firm owned by a relative. At the invitation of his uncle, Frank traveled to Atlanta for 2 weeks in late October 1907 to interview for a position with the National Pencil Company, a manufacturing plant in which the uncle was a major shareholder. So, sounds like it was a Jewish company. Frank accepted the position and traveled to Germany to study pencil manufacturing at Eberhard Faber in Bavaria. After a 9-month apprenticeship, Frank returned to the United States and began working at the National Pencil Company in August 1908. Leo Frank became superintendent of the factory in September 1908. The murder occurred in 1913, recall. Frank was introduced to Lucille Selig shortly after he arrived in Atlanta. She came from a prominent and upper middle class Jewish family of industrialists who 2 generations earlier had founded the first synagogue in Atlanta. Though she was very different from Frank and laughed at the idea of speaking Yiddish, They were married in November 10, 1910 at the Selig residence in Atlanta. I'll probably, in a future installment, dig into that statement there about the cultural differences between Frank and his wife. It sounds to me, just from what I know so far and this description, that Frank was an Ashkenazi Jew. His family's probably recently arrived from Eastern Europe, whereas his wife's family had been probably living for a long time in Atlanta and were probably descended from Sephardic Jews. But more on that later. Frank was elected president of the Atlanta chapter of the B'nai B'rith, a Jewish fraternal organization, in 1912. And I'd like to dig into the B'nai B'rith a bit more too, not right now, but in the future. The Jewish community in Atlanta was the largest in the South, and the Franks moved in a cultured and philanthropic milieu whose leisure pursuits included opera and bridge. At the time of Mary Fagan's murder, Frank was 29 years old and had supervised the factory for almost 5 years. At the end of the last installment, I cited an article as an exemplar of the Jewish version of the history behind the murder of Mary Fagan. And I pointed out that from the Jewish point of view, it isn't about Mary Fagan at all. And it isn't about any crime committed by Leo Frank. It's about Leo Frank being a victim and Jews in general being the victims. And just to recall, the article was titled An American Lynching, The Leo Max Frank Affair, and it was published in the Jerusalem Post in a blog titled Antisemitism and Jewish Survival by someone named David Turner. And he described the Frank case as one of three anti-Semitic outrages. And together with Frank, he named Menachem Bellis and Alfred Dreyfus. And I think it's important to reiterate this because this is, from the Jewish point of view, Frank is connected to these other two cases. And what David Turner spells out as well, he says that the reason the three of them are linked together in Jewish minds is because they represent this, quote, antipathy toward Jews that's endemic to Western culture. And he eventually ended that paragraph by referring to the Holocaust. And as I pointed out the last time, and as I want to reiterate this time, it's not just that Frank is related to these other two Jews and the trials that they went through at about the same time, but this is how it all fits into the Jewish narrative, their telling of their history amongst Europeans, that they have been oppressed and that the Europeans have been their oppressors. It's a very one-sided version. And of course, because of their the media influence that they've had since even before the 1913, but certainly in the 100 years since, they have convinced many non-Jews even to see history from a Jewish point of view. And that's kind of sick. But part of what I'm talking about in these installments and what I'm hoping to demonstrate is that there is a different version, that there's a different point of view of what happened. And in fact, the Jewish version is an inversion of reality. It's making the Jews into the victims, making Frank into a victim and the Jews in general into victims. And by focusing and drilling into this one case, I think that it won't just overturn people's thinking, listeners' thinking about this one case, but because the Jews themselves link it to these other two cases and to the larger Jewish narrative about blood libel and the Holocaust, that hopefully some listeners will, if they haven't already made this connection, see that it's all lies. It's not just the lies that they tell about Leo Frank, but their whole narrative is a lie. Their whole narrative is an inversion of reality. A book I ran into just by chance, but it caught my eye because it mentioned Bellis, and I had never heard the name Bellis before. I had heard of Dreyfus before. But the title of the book is The Jew Accused, Three Anti-Semitic Affairs, Dreyfus, Bellis, Frank. And I also recognize the author's name, Albert S. Lindemann. Kevin MacDonald has written an article about the Leo Frank affair and mentioned this book, and he cited it as one of the more balanced accounts, which is not saying too much, because most of the accounts are Jewish accounts told from a lopsided, one-sided Jewish view. But in his, in Kevin MacDonald's opinion, this book did a better job than most at being more even-handed. But even so, I thought that the description on Amazon for the book is interesting. It goes, three Jews, Alfred Dreyfus, Mendel Bellis, and Leo Frank, were charged with heinous crimes in the generation before World War I. Dreyfus of treason in France, Bellis of ritual murder in Russia, that's the blood libel according to the Jews, and Frank of a murder of a young girl in the United States. The affairs that developed out of their trials pulled hundreds of thousands of people into passionate confrontation. This study explores the nature of modern antisemitism and the ways that politicians in the generation before World War I attempted to use hatred of Jews as a political device to mobilize the masses. The antisemitism surrounding the affairs is presented as an elusive intermingling of real conflict between Jews and non-Jews, on the one hand, and on the other, fantasies about Jews derived from powerful myths deeply rooted in Western civilization. And there's that same narrative again, the anti-European, there's a problem between Jews and non-Jews, and it's all the non-Jews' fault. The phrase that David Turner used was antipathy toward Jews endemic to Western culture. The way this book description describes it as fantasies about Jews derived from powerful myths deeply rooted in Western civilization. Well, the word myth is an interesting word being used there, and it's an example of what I'm talking about when I say how they invert reality. The Jewish narrative inverts the reality. It's the Jews themselves making myths, not Europeans. It's not Europeans making myths up about Jews. It's the Jews who are making the myths. And here in this book, that's part of their myth-making. The article by David Turner, part of their myth-making. Their version being pumped out by their media and convincing people to see it from a Jewish point of view. They're the ones making the myth. On the other side, on the European side, or even just the neutral side, in this case, and what makes this case such a good case to do this with, is there's an extensive record collected at the time, both court records and newspaper articles. There's documentation, basically. You know, the thing about the Jewish blood libel myth and myth-making is that it's talking about events that are so far in the past that nobody could possibly know. I mean, that's one way to recognize that it's mythical and that it's probably not the way the Jews describe it, is that there aren't very good records about those things that happened hundreds of years ago or longer. But in the case of the Leo Frank murder of Mary Fagan, there are extensive records, and we're going to get into that other point of view, but I thought it would be good to present this Jewish point of view. You're going to hear it anyway. If you read, search for anything, any information about Leo Frank and Mary Fagan, you're going to get the Jewish point of view up front and loudest. And I'm not. I'm just trying to present the other side here, and I'm not alone. But more on that in a bit. There's another story I'd like to mention here, which was linked actually by the David Turner article. He linked to a news story that was printed in 2005 about some Jews in Georgia near, I guess it was on the location where Frank was lynched, where he was hung from a tree. They actually erected a plaque in 1995. And on the plaque, they had written, "Wrongly accused, falsely convicted, wantonly murdered." And that, you know, if you had to sum up the Jewish view of Leo Frank, you could do it in a single word, you know, anti-Semitism. But if you wanted to sum it up in a short phrase, that would be it. And it's worth reading it again. I'm going to read it several times because it's in future installments, because it's worth holding the Jews' feet to the fire on the way they describe this. Wrongly accused, falsely convicted, wantonly murdered. Well, that sounds like an indictment of the people of Georgia who accused Frank, convicted Frank, and then hung him from a tree. And I would say that the proper way, taking into account that the Jews are inverting history, the proper way to describe what happened is that Frank was accused, he was convicted, and he was punished. And of course, the story is more involved than that. There were quite a few curves in the road toward punishment. But in the end, justice was served. And in the 100 years since, the Jews, during the trial and in the 100 years since, what the Jews have done is derailed justice and twisted justice. In the article that talked about this plaque being erected, it was actually a second plaque that was being, I guess, replacing the original plaque that had been put down in 1995. The rabbi who was behind the establishment of this plaque was quoted as saying, "I believe remembering something, even though it is evil, assures that it is never perpetrated again." And this is how the Jews do what they do. It's evil from a Jewish point of view, and they want what they regard as evil to be remembered. In fact, they want it to be remembered as evil. They want it to be regarded as evil by everyone, and they want it to be remembered by everyone else. You know, basically the Jews are worried about their best interests, but they're not satisfied with that. They want everyone else to be worried about the best interests of Jews as well. And so they're willing to indoctrinate others. And so they do things like establishing these plaques and having press conferences to announce their commemoration, their honoring of their murderer. And the title of the article about this plaque was actually titled "Honoring Leo Frank." There's a very good website. Someone left a link in the comments to the first installment, leofrank.org, and it's a storehouse of all sorts of information about the Leo Frank and Mary Fagan case. And what I like about it is not only that it's got so much information on it, but it comes at it from the point of view that I share, this awareness that the Jewish point of view is an inversion of reality and that that's wrong and needs to be righted. And I want to quote a couple of paragraphs from that website that are very good. "Almost exclusively over the last 100 years, the books romanticizing Leo Frank as a tragic martyr of Gentile culture have been written by Jews. This website intends to put an end to this Jewish hoax by letting everyone know what really happened. This Leo Frank research library is doing something no one else has ever dared to do for the first time since the dramatic finale of the Leo Frank case on August 17, 1915. We are making the elusive 1,800-page official Georgia Supreme Court case documents on Leo Frank free to the public. This massive legal file had once been locked away in a vault of the Georgia State Archive since 1913, but now is available for the public to read in all unaltered high-resolution images. It's overwhelming, really, the amount of documentation that's available. No ordinary human being could be expected to read it. Only really an expert has the time to do it. And I just get this overwhelming feeling when I look at the all of the evidence. And you know what? I think it's not necessary, really, to dive in and understand all of the details. It's the Jews certainly don't do it to tell their narrative. They sum it up in a single word or in a single term that expresses their point of view, and that's what they indoctrinate people with. And we ought to keep that in mind. Continuing here, when modern independent scholars look back on 100 years of the written and cinematic history concerning Leo Frank case through the metaphor of an eagle flying above in the heavens, seeing the whole of the forest and not just the individual trees, and compare it against the dry leaves of the official trial and appeals records between 1913 and 1915, it reveals a very ugly, malicious, and hidden side of the Jewish community, one most Gentiles were not fully aware exists interwoven in the DNA of Jews. Unless one studies the cycles and patterns of Jewish history and social culture, the Leo Frank case is the doorway to understand the disfigured collective consciousness of American Ashkenazi Jewry. In fact, I would say that the lessons in examining this case, that's a pretty good description of it, and matches my own view, which is why I pulled out this paragraph to acknowledge that this website that I'm going to direct you to is on the right page. They seem to understand the import of this case, and they aren't trying to write the Jews out of it. They're not just trying to tell the case of the court and without recognizing the hostility from the Jewish side of it. In fact, a little further on in that same page, in a section titled The Southerner Perspective, Two Faces of One Case, on one side, the defense side of the case, the Leo Frank case evolved into an anti-Gentile blood libel, an anti-Southern cause célèbre for the Jewish community, nationally and internationally. And on the other side, Southerners became incensed with the relentless Jewish media defamation war waged against them and the unrelenting efforts to build national support for emotionally exonerating Leo Frank in the American heart. This is despite vindication of the Georgia courts by the United States Supreme Court. So what they're pointing out there is essentially what I described a little earlier here, that this is connected to the Jewish blood libel narrative, their tale of woe and their whole history. And in fact, they're inverting history, inverting reality by the reality is that they're libeling the Southerners who lived at the time that Frank was accused and convicted and punished for this crime. And to say that it was wrong, that it was wrongly done and unjust and the way the Jews describe it, is to essentially accuse those people that were involved in it of wrongdoing, to transfer the wrongdoing from Frank and from the Jews who manipulated the case to the people who were trying to see justice done, due process. Also on this leofrank.org website is a timeline. It's actually taken from another timeline I had run into independently at a website, georgiainfo.galileo.usg.edu. So it's, I'm guessing, a University of Georgia website titled the Leo Frank page. But what's notable about that page is that it's got very good timeline that just spells out in chronological order the events of the case. And as I said before already, it's overwhelming, really, even just looking at a timeline and trying to read it from beginning to end. All the names and the dates get overwhelming. And I will link it, and if you are interested in it, you can read it yourself. The leofrank.org page takes that basic data that was provided on that Georgia University site and adds to it, fleshes it out a bit. But one of the things when I was reading the timeline, especially at the beginning of the timeline, because I'm going to try and follow the case roughly in chronological order myself, is that Frank was not the first suspect. In fact, on the day after the murder was on 26th of April, the next day two men were arrested, a driver who had been known to drive Mary Fagan back and forth to work was arrested for the obvious reason. He had been seen by a witness with her the day of her disappearance. And the black night watchman who found the body. And then the next day, on the 28th, two more suspects were arrested that weren't Leo Frank, the former bookkeeper of the pencil company, and some unnamed black. On that day, this is 2 days after the murder, the chronology notes that police had to disperse a white mob that were threatening to lynch Newt Lee, the Black Night Watchman who had been arrested. And I think the interesting thing about this is, first of all, four other people were suspected and arrested before they ever got to Leo Frank. And the other thing that's interesting here is that the whites wanted to lynch the black man just based on the circumstantial evidence already before a trial had even occurred. Which is interesting because, the way the Jews paint the story, the fact that Leo Frank was lynched ultimately by a mob is, in their telling of the story, a sign that it was unjust. Whereas this fact is evidence that this is how murderers, especially murderers in under such heinous conditions, such outrageous conditions, were treated. That was the norm for that society at the time. Another document, another source of very good detailed documents on the trial is archive.org. Always a very good source. And again, I'm struck by the overwhelming nature of the information that's presented there. And to give you a sense of what I mean, one of the documents that they provide is the final closing arguments at the trial made by the prosecutor, Hugh Dorsey. And it describes it as a 9-hour final argument that was delivered. It took almost 3 days of court to deliver it. The trial itself had taken 29 days. The document that they provide of this 9-hour final argument is 158 pages long. And I don't intend to read it, but perhaps sections of it. But there are some other interesting things to discuss about that document. And I'll get to it. I'll have to get to it the next time because we're out of time this time. But please join me in part 3.